Welcome to the Canteen Podcast, a show for anyone who has feelings about food. Join host Ali Houston as guests open up about their relationship with food and their thoughts on nutrition. Nourish yourself with the Canteen Podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of the Canteen Podcast. I'm your host Ali Houston. Our guest today is Dr. Scott Murray. He's a super smart guy with an amazing clinical and research track record. I hope you enjoy. Please don't forget to jump over to iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast and hit the subscribe button. And please don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review to get the podcast in front of more eyes. This podcast is made possible thanks to paleocanteen.co.uk, which is my company. paleocanteen.co.uk is the UK's one-stop paleo and low-carb food provider, where you can get restaurant-quality meals, grass-fed Scottish beef and lamb, outdoor bred pork, and a selection of paleo and low-carb products, delivered chilled to your door. That's paleocanteen.co.uk. Use the code CANTEEN15, that's CANTEEN15, to get 15% off your first order. Thanks, and enjoy the show. We are recording, and we're lucky enough to have with us today Dr. Scott Murray, who is a consultant preventive cardiologist at Royal Liverpool University Hospital and president of the British Association for Cardiovascular Prevention and Rehabilitation. Welcome.
Thanks, Ali. Cheers. Thanks for having me on. I've been looking forward to it.
So you're a specialist in preventative cardiology after spending more than 10 years focused on intervention. So why did you make that shift, and what is your basic advice around preventing heart disease?
Okay, yeah. So I spent a long time training to actually put stents into people's arteries and to drag them out the water when they come in the throes of a heart attack. And it was the second year of being a consultant doing that in Liverpool, and I'd basically seen everything by then that you could possibly see. But I saw a 42-year-old woman brought in basically crashing, well, near death in essence, just about to die. And when we went into her arteries to see what was going on, she had two of her three main arteries were blocked. And she was running on one artery, sort of giving the blood to her entire heart and cross-filling the two blocked ones. And I didn't know which one was an old blockage and which one was a new blockage. So we went in and we were poking them to see, and one opened up. So we opened that and stented it. And the other one we couldn't open because it was just old and chronic and had probably been there for, you know, years. And afterwards, when we got back to the ward, I just said to her, look, you know, what's been going on in your life? And she said, you know, everyone in my family's dead before 50. And my, you know, my brother had a bypass, then he died. And, you know, we went into all the history, but when I actually got down to her and said, you know, got the blood test back, she was a raging diabetic. She had, you know, cholesterol levels that were compatible with having a lipid disorder, or FH, if you know what that is, familial hyperlipidemia. And she was overweight, she smoked. And I just sort of said to her, you know, what do you eat? What do you drink? You know, what's your diet like? I said, well, I don't drink water. I just drink, you know, full sugar Coke. So I drink about two bottles of that a day. You know, I smoke about 30 a day. And your diet was just, you know, the worst it could possibly be. And from that point forward, I got in contact with every single member of her close family. So all her siblings, all her, you know, her daughter, her son. And I went through the entire family tree and I saw them personally in my clinic. And I just tried to iterate to them that, you know, they're all on a genetic path to death before 50. You know, they've got all the wrong genes lined up wrongly and their lifestyle is all wrong. And I tried systematically to knock every one of them onto a different path. And it wasn't easy. You know, I'd probably still not really achieved anything with them, but she's still alive. And I know that her two brothers are still alive, and that the kids have all been counselled and taken forward in terms of smoking and stuff. So I felt like I'd kind of done what I should have done there, and that set me thinking about all the other ones I'd seen. And every time I got called then to see another primary, I was thinking, you know, this person, if it got to them 10 years earlier, this might not have happened. So, and I was fed up getting up in the middle of the night, getting called out to put the stents in. And my wife got a job as a consultant. We had three rotors in one house. So I just had my fill by then, and a chance came to switch roles and someone wanted my job. So I just said, there you go, you can, good luck. I'm going to start focusing on prevention. And no one really doing that at that point. Everyone was doing their own little thing. So the fact that I went into prevention at the moment, I'm probably one of two or three preventive cardiologists in the UK. And that role was just conjured up by me. And luckily, my trust supported me in it. So the NHS Trust kept me employed. And that's basically what happened. That's how that transpired. In terms of what people should do to not have a heart attack, you can't choose your parents, unfortunately. And that's a massive thing. You know, if you inherited some dodgy genetics, it does create the base for your risk, unfortunately. And then if you then go and drink full sugar Coke and don't drink water, smoke and have a crap diet, you know, you're almost there, because you'll get high blood pressure, no doubt. If you're sedentary, you know, you're not really burning anything off, and you know, that's you. But the smoking and the high sugar diet is the killer, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But don't do that. That's the advice.
Yeah, I mean, you're working in Liverpool. My girlfriend's from Liverpool. So.
Oh, yeah, you told me that. Yeah, yeah.
So,
you've been down here, have you?
Yeah, I've been down there a few times, and I think it's an amazing city, and it has a lot in common with Glasgow.
Yeah.
There's a sort of northern industrial town thing going on, post-industrial, bit of a chip on its shoulder in a good way, but also like severe problems due to industry disappearing and people with very little purpose sometimes, and very low incomes and dreadful dietary culture and all the rest of it.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, how do you rank smoking compared to diet, compared to what's going on in someone's life in terms of all their heart disease risk?
Yeah, I mean, I think smoking's for me is one of the biggest things that you can, you know, if you can get off that, that's been shown in multiple studies to be so powerful in terms of an intervention. So, but it's the thing we do really badly. We don't invest in it. We've got worse at it in some cases in the past sort of 5 or 10 years. I'll tell you a funny story. We in Liverpool, we were having a campaign about smoking cessation, trying to, you know, well, let's get this sorted and let's see what's actually happening. And a new company came in to do a private company to do the sort of smoking cessation referrals. They won the tender. And the nurses and everyone still doing their bit referring patients to smoking cessation. It used to be called fag ends in Liverpool. And when we looked into it, we realised that all these referrals were just going into the ether. They weren't actually getting picked up by this company. So we there's an IT glitch here. We need to get a laptop. So we asked the trust for some money. Didn't have any money to buy a basic laptop. So we went into like charitable funds and stuff. Eventually one of the respiratory consultants got this laptop and he was like, yeah, I've got a smoking cessation laptop. We're sorted now. All the referrals are going to go and everything's going to work. And then I saw him about 3 days later and I was like, is it working yet, Gareth? And he's like, nah, the laptop got nicked. Within about like 3 days of getting this laptop, it got nicked.
Dear.
So Liverpool's an interesting place, and it is just like Glasgow. And the thing is, the people there genuinely love Scottish people. So maybe that's how your missus is like she was seduced by your dulcet Scottish tones. the place is a fresh food desert. Basically, there's no, we've looked at this from the council perspective, and we've written a cardiovascular prevention strategy for the entire city, saying structurally how should you change what happens in this city to prevent heart disease, and the council have signed it off. It's all been sort of passed through, everything needs to be done, but actually getting the traction is the difficult bit, because there's so many changes at the council. You know, they're more concerned about potholes in the road than they are about, you know, what's going on, that you really only need to walk about 250 yards in a year at a fast food venue in Liverpool. So yeah, there's not much in the way of fresh food going on, or the ability to get fresh food easily, fast food everywhere. So yeah, that kind of sums up most major cities, I suppose. But we are, in terms of how bad it is, Liverpool was classically always third in the league tables of cardiovascular death. So Manchester always wins. They're always top of the table, not just in football, but in heart disease death. And it's linked to, you know, deprivation, basically. Mm-hmm. Birmingham came through and are round about second these days, and the Midlands has got a sort of rising problem because of the influence of ethnic minorities and the fact that they get diabetes earlier. Mm. I think they're, you know, fast becoming a group of people who are going to get ill quicker in this environment, in this, you know, obesogenic environment. So yeah, we've fallen behind Birmingham and Nottingham, I think, the Midlands, and I think Liverpool are now sort of sixth or seventh. So we're not as bad as we used to be, but it's mainly, there's still a life expectancy gap of about 12 to 15 years between the most affluent part and the least affluent. So there's a massive social gradient. And a lot of that is smoking too. So 50% smoking rates in one part of Liverpool and, you know, 5 to 10% in another. So, does that answer your question? I can't remember what else you said because we're just sort of chatting, but...
Yes, it does. I've just lost your video there. You're going to come back? Yeah, that's it. It's back now. It's similar in Glasgow. You know, there's the difference between the West and the East End's probably 20 years. And yeah, in terms of life expectancy, and you know, they talk about the Glasgow effect, and I need to check that. Don't quote me on that, but they talk about the Glasgow effect, and you know, all these kind of speculations about why people in Glasgow live even shorter lives than people in places like Liverpool, and you know, some people say it's the prevalence of deep fried food. Some people say it's the fact that you're that wee bit further north and don't get as much sun.
Yeah.
And I do wonder about that in terms of ethnic minorities who have darker skin and need more sun to get more vitamin D, whether there's a causal factor there.
I see tons of vitamin D deficiency. And they often come with chest pain. They're often of ethnic minority and they come with that chest or body pain, and then you say, you know, it's not cardiac pain. You know, you press their chest or they move and it's sore, and you say, have you had your vitamin D checked? And they say, yeah, I'm really low in vitamin D. And you're like, well, you know, vitamin D can cause, you know, pains, you know, bone pain to a certain extent. And I mean, the Glasgow effect, I think, is a combination of like deprivation, you know, crap food habits and smoking, and you know, kind of raining all the time. There's not much sun, is there? And you know, it's I was just talking to my dad there actually, because he's still in Wishaw, and this will sum it up. And I said, well, what are you doing tomorrow? And he's like, oh, yeah, I'm going to the golf and blah blah blah. I said, yeah. And then afterwards we go in, you know, you get pie chips and beans and you know, a few pints, you know. And I was like, oh, really? I was like, what, can you not have a rolling pie anymore? Because I don't know whether you remember this, but I remember distinctly a lot of rolling pies going on. So for those that are watching, a scotch pie in a buttered roll with like ketchup on it, and then you just sort of like smash it together and then just bite into the roll. So it's just like
absolutely dreadful.
If you put chips and beans with that, then you're definitely onto a winner.
Yeah, I mean, for lunch I used to sometimes go to a pizza place in Glasgow and get the pizza crunch and
deep fried pizza
with chips on the side, and sometimes a rolling fritter, which for those who don't know is a buttered roll with a massive chip inside of it.
Yeah, you used to have that for lunch at school.
Yeah, and they would give you that plus a packet of Space Raider crisps and a Quenchy cup for, I think it was 140. I mean, it was too cheap. They knew exactly how much you were getting for lunch, your lunch money, and then you would fall asleep the rest of the day. But it's absolutely terrible. And I think, like, smoking's got to be number one, though, hasn't it? Like, you hear all those interviews that Ivor Cummins did with Joseph Kraft, the doctor who did all those insulin tests on people. And he said in his book, if you smoke, put this book down and give it to someone else, because your diet isn't going to help you, which is really interesting.
I think it just sets it all on fire, quite literally. You know, the smoking and the high sugar. I mean, look at whatever her name was, Carrie Fisher, the Princess Leia. She had a heart attack on a flight, age 60 or something, and she was a confirmed full fat coke addict and smoke. So, I mean, I think the combination of two, well, those things are pretty bad news in terms of inflaming your system. I mean, looking back, when you say you used to have like a rolling fritter and stuff, some of the stuff that we used to eat, I mean, you used to walk to the chippy at lunchtime at school. I mean, who else does that? Walks to a chippy and gets like a half pizza, deep fried pizza, or as you say, a rolling fritter and a can of Iron Brew, when Iron Brew was real, you know, like 40 grams of sugar or whatever. And then I started thinking back to my childhood. Now, my grandmother worked in Greggs the Baker's in Wishaw, and I spent my Saturdays with my grandparents. My dad was playing golf every day, every Saturday. And we used to go and pick her up from the side of the door. She'd come out the side of the Greggs. She'd been working in the morning. I would always get a Bridie, and you might need to explain what a Bridie is to people, and a can of like 7-Up and like a cheap treacle donut or something. And then we'd drive to Hamilton and we'd go around the shops. And then like about 3 o'clock, I'd get like in BHS, I'd get like sausage and chips and like Coke and an ice cream or something. But the funny thing was, she used to say to me, you were a fat wee boy, and you were a chubby teenager, and then, you know, you've always had quite a fat arse, haven't you? And she used to say these things to me. I'd be like, you were the one fucking feeding me. It's like, I don't think she really made the connection, and I was just a kid in like food heaven for a kid, you know, just like nom. And then you look back and you're like, you know, I wonder why, you know, despite all the exercise, despite all the footy teams and all that, you know, you couldn't shift some weight. You know, you were still a bit podgy around the edges. And that's it in a nutshell.
Yeah. And you spoke about the kind of things that, you know, Carrie Fisher was doing, or that woman that you treated who had a heart attack. The things that are just so bad that they're the low-hanging fruit that you can cut out. So the smoking, the full fat cans, the full sugar cans of Coke.
Sugar-sweetened beverage, yeah.
Yeah, you're talking about starchy, stodgy stuff as well. So like the Bridie being a sort of pastry filled with meat, but, you know, it's mainly pastry, and it's probably mainly vegetable fat as well nowadays.
Yeah.
And, chips. Just basically potatoes fried in vegetable oil.
Crappy sausages fried in vegetable oil. You know, I mean, I don't even know what the meat is in a Bridie. I mean, what is it, the bit around a pig's arsehole or something like that? I don't even know. It's like
some hooves.
Pork mincemeat or something. The cut-offs, yeah, the whatever. I don't know what it is. certainly not grass fed. Sort of,
no, not paleo compatible.
Whatever it is, yeah. But it's just interesting looking back.
Yeah, I mean, I came from an environment where I suppose when my mum was cooking for us, she would have like a menu that she would have, you know, Monday was this, Tuesday was that usually. And it was like a kind of roster of things that looking at the way I eat now would be, some of them would seem quite healthy to me and some of them not so. But they all had meat or fish or, you know, something nutritious in it and some vegetables. But then, you know, maybe it would be potatoes, maybe it would be fried potatoes, maybe it would be chips, maybe it would be, you know, some potato salad or something like that. And I think a little treat after dinner as well. So maybe get a bit of chocolate or something. And I put on weight when I was a child and I had a bit of a chocolate addiction, you know, that if I had any spare money, then it would go on hoovering up sweets. And I didn't really lose the weight. And I played a lot of rugby when I was a teenager, and then I was fairly skinny at that time. And then in my 20s, I was, you know, I kept piling it on, and I couldn't work out why. And then it wasn't until I went sort of paleo low carb that the weight just melted away.
Yeah.
I mean, you talked about the sort of worst offenders. How do you eat nowadays? And, you know, do you find that it's easy for you to eat that way?
Yeah, I mean, majority of the time, if I've got control over what I'm eating, I'm not too bad. The issue is when something gets put in front of me that I'm not in control of, and that is prone to me kicking off on some sort of hedonic carb crash where I'll I'll just go off my tits basically on something. And are you going to censor this or anything? Are we allowed to swear?
I don't think so. No, I just there's just a wee button you click that says it's explicit.
All right, okay. I'm going to have to say to people I'm in an explicit video on the internet now. it just depends. If I've got control of what's on offer, then I'm not too bad. Like at work and stuff, I tend to, like, I won't probably eat breakfast. I'll probably just have like a coffee in the morning, then I'll go to work. And that, if I don't eat in the morning, I find that I can go through to like one, half one, and I'm not that bad. And then I feel like about half one, yeah, I'm probably going to eat something now. So I'm actually listening to my body saying, yeah, you need to eat something. I'll just drink water the rest of the time. But then when I eat something, like today, I went to Tesco across the road, so I didn't have any food with me, and I just bought two packets of the roast beef and dipped it in some guacamole. And you can get two packets for £3 with some guacamole for £1 or something. So a bottle of water, it's about a fiver. I'll do that now and again just to try and keep control. And whilst it's still kind of a little bit processed, it's better than if I eat a sandwich or, you know, I see people constantly just buying sandwich meal deals at my work and around the place, or going to Subway, which is across the road, and getting a foot long with a free cookie, and that sort of stuff winds me up. I don't know whether you've seen the PHC UK talk from a couple of years ago, but I mean, it's just like the sandwich subculture with the whole, oh, you know, if you get a packet of crisps and a Mars bar, it's 50 pence cheaper, and people get sucked into that. I just see so many people doing that who are just massively overweight, and I just keep thinking, mate, it's not going to happen. So yeah, that's what I did for lunch. When I came home tonight, I actually went round the corner to Morrison's. We've got a Morrison's round the corner, and I went to the hot chicken counter. Now, I don't know what they cook it in, or it goes on a rotisserie, so I don't know what they do, but I got us in the family a hot chicken and some bacon ribs, and we had that for dinner with a salad. So when I'm in control, it's all right. It's just when it's like, you know, someone's birthday and someone brings in a chocolate cake, or my wife's got this habit of picking up, like, you know, yum yums or something like that. And, you know, my grandmother worked in Greggs, for Christ's sake. You know, the sniff of a yum yum is enough to take me back to some sort of like childhood dopamine Valhalla where, you know, I'm just gonna take that and just end up, you know, lying on my back for it somewhere. So I do find it difficult from time to time, and I'm sure everyone does. I've talked to Jen Unwin and stuff about this as well. You know, I sent her a message once saying, Jen, I'm spooning Nutella into my mouth, help. So I put on my Twitter, Hippocratic hypocrisy. So, you know, even though, you know, you've got this front as a doctor saying to people, you know, don't do this, don't do that, you actually find yourself sometimes doing those things thinking, I am, you know, a massive hypocrite here. You know, I had 6 beers last night, or, you know, had, like, I told that guy to cut down on his alcohol intake, and then I went to the pub and had a couple of pints, or, you know, I had a half a bottle of wine in my dinner or something. So, you know, you're stuck between this sort of catch-22 where you know what you should and shouldn't be doing, but occasionally you just get sucked into doing the wrong thing. I absolutely do not drink a full sugar cocoa. That's one thing that I never do, and I don't smoke. As I say, and I try to keep the diet as clean as I can, really. But it's not easy, like you say.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a kind of office food culture, and often it involves sugar addiction manifesting in buying cakes in.
Oh, yeah.
Or whatever, for any minor occasion. And yeah. I know that, so I mean, I run my own business, so I can sort of interact with who I want, but people I know, you know, like my girlfriend or other people, they're constantly trying to do the right thing by their diet, but it's every other day you've got cake thrust in front of you, and you're seen as a killjoy if you don't partake. And
no, yeah, totally.
And you're obviously facing your own long-standing addictions to these things. And like you say, this this sort of emotional dopamine attachment to super unhealthy foods. It's not easy. And I think the other thing about signaling that you know what the right thing is and this is what you should do as a position of authority, in a position of authority, it does set you up as a kind of bastion of purity. And I think, like, unless you preface every single thing that you say with, listen, I'm not perfect, but you're not, you know, no, I don't think anyone should expect you to be doing that. And if occasionally, you know, my girlfriend does have a bit of cake, then someone will be there like, ah, I thought you were low carb. And it's like, well, I'm low carb. I'm doing this, you know, 90% of the time. You're never doing it.
That's a hard balance to fight. And people at work now, I mean, people come up to me and say, oh yeah, I was really skeptical, but, you know, I've tried this, you know, and I've lost 12 pounds. You know, I've never lost 12 pounds in my life. And there's a couple of, like, a guy I share an office with, I mean, he's a cardiologist. He got some results back. You know, he'd put on a bit of till, to be fair. He was a bit heavy. And he got some results back showing his HbA1c was like in the high 40s, and he got a real shock. And I just said to him, look, you got to do this. He admitted he was, you know, going home, you know, making ice cream smoothies. He was, you know, nailing biscuits. He loves crisps. So he was just, you know, as soon as he got in from work, he was just like, you know, Cookie Monster, just like, rah, 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 rah. And then just go to bed and, you know, and he's now about to break the 70 kilos barrier, which he's never done in his life. He's about to hit like 69 kilograms, having been, you know, in the high 80s and 90s. And within 4 weeks, I said, get your HbA1c checked again after 4 weeks now. You're meant to check it every 3 months, but actually changes rather quickly. And the test itself, this is a test of how sugary your red blood cells are. Changes within 4 weeks. He went from a 46 or a 48 down to like a 32. So he really, you know, any sort of diabetic physiology he had just went within 4 weeks.
Wow.
This is the difficult thing, is that, you know, I think there's a lot of, there's maybe 4 or 5 really bad things that people are doing religiously or as part of their norm what they do day in, day out, they're probably sabotaging themselves with maybe three things. And that if they just were able to just say, I'm going to take one of them out, and then the next week I'm going to take the other one out, and then the third week I'm going to remove that one, and I'm trying to get all those things out of my diet and out of my lifestyle, then, you know, within those 4, maybe 6 weeks, you can see a real dramatic change.
It's amazing that it's that quick. That's great. There's you know, statin drugs are often prescribed to people nowadays. There's people in my family who've been prescribed statin drugs. Can you talk about their role in heart disease treatment as you see it?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, as a cardiologist and most GPs, we've been, to a certain extent, bombarded with the evidence on statins over, you know, the last 15 years. And these seminal statin trials, the ones that came out, like West of Scotland Coronary Prevention Study, WASCOPS it was called, with pravastatin, run out of Royal Infirmary in Glasgow back when I was a medical student. And there was one in Scandinavia called 4S, Simvastatin Scandinavian Survival Study. The results of those trials were really quite breathtaking in terms of what they achieved for heart disease. And when you delve into the data on those trials, the maximum benefit given from those drugs was actually in the people who were most riddled. So the people who were metabolically bad, so your diabetics, your people with FH, people who've got like abnormal triglyceride HDL ratios, highlighting that they've probably got some form of metabolic syndrome. But there's no doubt that if your cholesterol's high, it's a sign that something's going wrong metabolically. So that's what I use it as now. Now, in the past, it used to be just a signal for the statin gun. And that's what GPs still tend to do. Oh, your cholesterol's up, you need to go on a statin. It's almost like a brainstem reflex now, because the amount of money that was poured into trials and evidence for statin drugs by the pharma companies back in the day when they were money-making blockbusters. Like atorvastatin made billions, you know, probably, I don't know what the exact thing is, you could look it up, but it's probably like 50 billion that drug made for Pfizer. And it was because the trials were so well done and to get those drugs into guidelines, the biggest level of evidence you can have is a randomized controlled trial. And these trials were very slick. They were done really well, and they did show benefit in a lot of cases. There were a lot of sort of other trials that maybe were done that didn't see the light of day. We'll never know about that. Mm. But ultimately, there's a group in Oxford run by Professor Sir Rory Collins who got all the statin data together and basically mashed it into this statistical chart, which is like a regression line for your cholesterol, and shows that for every millimole you drop your cholesterol, there's a gain in terms of your cardiovascular outcomes. So all the data is there to say that they do good. Now the question is, do they do good just because they lower cholesterol, or do they do good because they're influencing the amount of oxidized LDL cholesterol that can be in the bloodstream, and the ability for the body to become inflamed, and the ability for the cholesterol to actually make it into the arterial wall. So I think, to sum up, statins, should you be on one? I would say only if you've got heart disease and that has been shown by a CT scan, for instance. So if I went in a scanner and I got a calcium score of more than 100 and I had it in important places like the left main stem or a main artery in the front of my heart, and my cholesterol was up, and when you put it all into a risk calculator, I come out with a more than 10% risk of heart disease in the next 10 years, I'd probably consider it. And the reason for that is not just because of the cholesterol, but because of the fact that there are studies to show that it can do something. Mm-hmm. Now, there are other studies, if you want to nitpick on it, there's a question around what does it actually do for certain groups. So there's another side to the coin here. There are lots of people who are running around with really high cholesterols, okay, really high LDLs. But if they are eating a low-carb diet or keto diet, and they're quite thin and they're very, very, you know, active, it is possible that they're using cholesterol as their fuel, okay, because they're not utilizing glucose. They're probably using free fatty acids and ketones, and that's how they're fueling their body. Now, their cholesterols are going to be high. Are they at risk of heart disease? Well, if they've got every other duck in a line, so they're, you know, getting enough sleep, you know, they're not inflamed, and they've got the right genetics, then the likelihood is that they're not going to be in the same state as some person who's got high cholesterol because they're metabolically damaged. Your problem is that your average punter who comes to a GP or a cardiologist is not a keto runner. And this is the problem, is that as soon as you mention statins or cholesterol online, you know, you get a whole bunch of health activist keto people who are tuned in and know all the science and are really, you know, pretty smart, coming in and sending, you know, oh, this is rubbish, and just, you know, a whole load of Twitter storm. Your average punter on the street doesn't even know what a carb is. You know, they don't understand the difference between carbs and fats. And, you know, they're just eating food and they think, oh, maybe I should reduce my calories. That's what Public Health England says, you know, 400, 400, 600 or something, that mantra thing they've got. They have not got a jot about, you know, what's happening at their liver, you know, why their cholesterol's up. They're not even sure what cholesterol is. They've heard about good and bad cholesterol. They don't have a clue. And a lot of people, if you said to them about changing their lifestyle, they just can't embrace it. So there is a treatment gap there, where you could be given, if someone has heart disease proven, either had a heart attack or, you know, is riddled with, you know, diabetes, metabolic disease, fatty liver, these sort of things, there is a potential gap there that you could be giving someone something that might help. Now, unless you do pharmacogenomics and all those sort of weird and wonderful testings, you don't know whether they're going to be statin tolerant or intolerant. So it's a bit of a fire and forget. And I think GPs and stuff are sort of doing it because they think they're doing good. And sometimes for a majority of people who don't have heart disease and just have a high cholesterol, they might not be doing them good. So it's a long-winded story, but it's trying to sum up how there's probably, you know, two or three elements to it.
Yeah, it makes sense. And it's the kind of picture that I've built up over time myself, listening to people like yourself online, because as you say, there's a real, there's a loud voice saying there's no case for using them. And maybe theoretically, in a perfect world where everyone responds to good information in the right way, that's true. Because I would have thought, and I don't know if you agree, that mitigating lifestyle factors is probably far more powerful than effects of statins. But like you say, this treatment gap is real. You're at the coalface where you're seeing people who don't understand that. I might actually find it hard to get rid of even the smoking and the drinking Coke. So, you know, you'd be remiss in your Hippocratic Oath if you didn't do what you could to help them at that point.
Yeah, I mean, those early studies in statins, I mean, you could criticise the 4S simvastatin one, because actually the guy who did the stats on the trial worked for the drug company. So all the stats went through the Merck statistician. And that, to me, is dodgy. And when you read the paper, there's a few things in it that just don't add up. So I do wonder that before, you know, modern day, you know, control of clinical trials where you had to register on websites, it had to be an independent statistician, you had to show everything you were going to be measuring. I think maybe what happened back in the day was that, you know, they bunged a whole load of people on it. It was randomized. And then the data came out and went through the company, and then there was a forward-looking statement came out, and then it just snowballed from there. But, you know, there are a lot of trials and there's a lot of evidence, and there's a lot of even basic science to support some of the stuff that statins do. The problem is that you're interfering with biology, and I don't really think that's often a good thing. That pathway is there for a reason. The mevalonate pathway and HMG-CoA reductase. The issue is that if we could only just get people to realize that, you know, they can do the stuff that these drugs do with their diet and with their lifestyle. Like, if you can, you know, stop insulin overstimulating the liver to make more cholesterol, then you will naturally reduce the liver from making it, you know, and the body reacts really well. You know, if you're taking in more fat, it won't make as much. The problem is a lot of the saturated fat in the blood is actually coming from carbohydrate consumption, and the body making its own saturated fat rather than the saturated fat that you're eating to a certain extent. So if we could just get the message out to people that, you know, change your diet, you might not need to take a statin if you don't already have heart disease, or if you've been through a calcium score and your calcium score's, you know, zero or less than 10, then, you know, I would say don't. There's no evidence that statins do anything. You know, if you're extremely elderly, they shouldn't be on statins. I mean, I see people coming into hospital and they're 89 and they're on a statin, and I just say, what are we trying to achieve here? Just take it off. I mean, is that maybe why she's a lot frailer than she was 5 years ago?
Because she went on. Because it can cause some muscle problems, can't it?
Yeah, so you just don't know. But, you know, there are, you know, it's nuanced. And I think that the polarization of the statin debate is taking away from the nitty gritty, and that, you know, yes, it's not for everybody. And I think it's wrong to just blanket bomb statins in just because the cholesterol's up a wee bit. You know, take a history. I mean, I've got a guy who came to the clinic whose triglycerides were 10, and I said, look, mate, what are you actually eating? And he said, look, can I be honest with you? I have 4 muffins for my breakfast. And I was like, well, stop doing that. And then I said, well, what do you have for your evening meal? He said, well, I don't really like going out of the house, so I phone in 2 Chinese meals, and I eat them every night. So he was just basically eating two main Chinese meals at night and having 4 muffins for his breakfast in the morning. And that was the guy's diet, day in, day out. You know, you're just like, no wonder your triglycerides are 11. And we basically stopped all that, got him back 3 months later, his triglycerides were 1. So, you know, you can achieve massive things with diet and just telling people, you know, that's not right, mate. You know, this 4 muffins for breakfast, not a good way forward.
It's great when people respond like they just need to be told. And I guess that's why a good way for all these lifestyle changes to get spread is through doctors, both in the clinic and on social media. I mean, do you think social media is a good medium to get information about medicine out there?
I think if it's from the right sources, I mean, I think if it's from credible individuals who are, you know, balanced in their approach, I think that that's fine, because it is always going to be more complex. That's another one of my strap lines on Twitter. It's always more complex than just being one thing. You know, we blame the carbs, we blame insulin, you know, we blame all these things, but it's almost always more nuanced than that and much more complicated. But as human beings, we like to drill it down to one or two things we're familiar with. There might be 100 different things we have yet to discover that we don't know anything about. So I think that, you know, that's just human nature. But just getting simple messages out to people it is a good thing. You know, the amount of people that come to my clinic, and I now just ask everybody what they eat, they come say, really healthy diet, really healthy diet. And I was like, oh, really? So, you know, why do you think your HbA1c is 104? You know, you're really sugary, there's something wrong here, so just tell me what you eat. And almost always, bar none, well, I have my bran flakes in the morning with banana on top, and then lunchtime I'll have sandwich on brown bread, by the way, really healthy brown bread, and that'll be, you know, brown bread sandwich, and then I'll have occasionally have a wee packet of crisps for that, you know, sort of, you start to get into the thing, and then, you know, main meal, it's normally pasta, mm-hmm. big pasta thing with you know, tomatoes, you know, sort of bolognese sauce or something. And I'm just thinking, where's the protein here? There's nothing. And, you know, it's just such a shame. I think there's so many people that the information is just all wrong. And I think that any human being with any sense, given the right information to go forward, can make a massive change. And I think that's why, you know, we all do this, is that we hope that the penny drops or the seed gets sown in some people's head, where they think, well, yeah, well, you know, maybe, like David Unwin says, maybe brown bread and bananas and bran flakes and stuff isn't a very good choice for someone who's diabetic. And that's what I think we just need to keep driving forward with.
Yeah, I think it is filtering out there. You mentioned before about getting a coronary artery calcium scan. And more and more people are talking about that to show the status of heart disease, you know, that's that you can see the disease in situ. Yeah. I mean, maybe you could talk about the test, what it is, and whether you need to use other tests or not to get a complete picture of what's happening.
Yeah, so it's probably the best test known disease. I'm getting a message saying your internet connection is unstable. Okay, I think it's still working. Yeah, so then the reason for that is it's low radiation. It takes about literally 5 minutes. You don't have to go in one of those enclosed scanners where people who are claustrophobic can't handle it. That's an MRI. So it's just a big polymint like CT scanner. You don't need to inject any contrast or any iodine-based contrast to light the arteries up for the first part of the test. And effectively, when we put you through the scanner, we're slicing the heart using CT into about 50 slices. And you examine every slice in detail, and you can actually see the heart arteries running on top of the heart muscle in the distribution. So you know whether they're connected properly, but then you can also see whether there's any signal of bright white chalk, a bit like the ribs show up white. So if there's any calcium on the heart arteries, that's you basically diagnosing that you've got disease there. The reason why that happens is that heart artery disease is a bit like corroding up the inside of a pipe, if you want to put it in simple terms. So if you can imagine you're down in a sewer and you're looking at the pipe itself, all the crap that's sort of lining the pipe is what we call atherosclerosis, so furring up of the pipe in essence. But the final stages of that furring up is calcification. And what the body does is to try and stop that plaque from breaking off and causing a heart attack, or clotting and causing a heart attack, he actually cements it over. And that's what calcification is. It's just like getting a plasterer in and getting them to do like a nice smooth job on it. And it's just the body's way of shoring that plaque up and stopping it from being, you know, the difference between a really soft boiled egg and a really hard boiled egg. That it's tough, and if you poked it, it wouldn't burst. So that's what calcium, well-developed calcium within these lesions, you're actually at less risk of it bursting because it's more stable. And that's the conundrum in calcification, is that you can have quite a high calcium score, but in actual fact, your arteries are just well cemented. And it's not good for the function of the artery in terms of its responsiveness and vasoactiveness, but in terms of the plaque being more stable, it does help. And statins actually do that. They increase calcification of the plaque. Now, it's not a good thing to have what we call a spotty calcified plaque. So that's a soft plaque with a bit of calcium developing in it. And you can imagine that a bit like if you dropped a piece of a pepper pod into an egg, yolk, you've got this area of solid impurity within a more soft mass, and that, you know, if you blew on it, or if you imagine blood pressure coming down the pipe and just basically ripping the skin off the plaque, or the movement of the solid impurity can create areas of weakness around that solid impurity. So it's basically gets down to biomechanics if you want to get into the nitty gritty of it. Having plaque is bad. Calcifying the plaque in the initial stages is probably a bit of instability developing. But then once you get full-blown calcification, it actually can stabilise things. But from your average punter, if they've got calcium, all it means is they've got disease, and therefore they need to take action and try and find out why they've got that, and cut the lifestyle off at the roots, whatever it is they've been doing that, you know, could have fueled this. There's still some people who've got really great lifestyles and have got terrible artery disease because of genetics and you know, things that they've maybe inherited. So, you know, there's still a lot we don't understand.
And is the coronary artery calcium score the only thing you need to see the plaques properly, or is there anything else that you use?
So if you went on and had a CT coronary angiogram, that's injecting contrast down, you can actually see the total plaque burden. So you can see the combination of non-calcified plaque and calcified plaque. And often what you see is that around the little spots of calcium, I often see this, there's non-calcified plaque around it. And basically, you know, that would all become calcified in the future. It's just at the moment, it's just evolving. Calcium scanning doesn't give you the full picture, doesn't give you the total plaque burden. If you wanted to go deeper into the study of atherosclerosis, then you can also scan the neck. So you can do carotid ultrasound scan to look for carotid plaque, which is a sign that you might, if your arterial wall is thickening, then there's a sign that you're starting to have the early process in the neck arteries. But often what's happening in the neck arteries is not a direct reflection of what's happening in the coronary arteries. And that's one of the weird things, is that it tends to happen at specific sites in the heart artery. So areas where the blood flow stress, or the shear stress we call it, is low. There's various caveats to that.
That's interesting that it develops where the stress is low, the blood pressure.
Yeah, so it's weird, because what happens is, say, I don't know whether you've ever looked at a river that's rushing down and hitting a breaking point. Where the river breaks and splits, on that bank there'll be no debris. Yeah, but on the opposite bank, from where you're standing, if you're standing where the river breaks, you'll see where the ebbs and flows are. Mm. That's where the leaves and the spawn and the shopping trolleys will be. Because when that blood rushes down and hits an arterial bifurcation, the cells that line that endothelium are happy, because they're getting constantly hit by flow. And if you're in a good physical state, the lining of the artery is happy, the endothelium is happy, and it can stay protected. But on the opposite bank, or the opposite side, where there's low shear stress, that low ebb and flow there actually means that the cells aren't getting stimulated quite as much, and there's a longer contact and resident time on those areas for, you can imagine, glycation, for oxidized lipids to just hang about and stick in that area for just a wee while longer than it would at the main branching point. So we tend to see atherosclerosis building up in areas of low shear stress at bifurcations. That's the main point we'll see it.
Interesting. Does that
make sense?
Yeah. That's a really interesting finding. I did not know that. So I guess if people are going through all this, would you expect what you're talking about to be the kind of standard of care that anyone would find if they go in to get their heart checked now? Or do you think your level of investigation and advice is exceptional.
I think it's filtering through. I mean, recently, whose dad had a heart attack at age 50. His dad was quite a heavy smoker, and he was asking me about this. And he's a smoker, and I said, look, you should just get one of these scans done just to know. I said, go and see your GP and see if he'll refer you in to get one done. So he went to see his GP, and his GP basically just said, no, I don't think the NHS should be paying for this. And he was basically just cut him off. I was a bit cross about that because, you know, when does a 48-year-old man actually go to the GP and declare that he's concerned about his heart health and that his dad died at, well, didn't die, but had a big heart attack at 50 and sort of go there opening himself up to the GP and say, please help me do my cholesterol, do my blood sugars. You know, how often does that actually happen in the real world? Very rare. And then this GP just slaps him down and says, no, off you pop. So I ended up just arranging it for him myself. And he got it done this week, actually, and he got a zero. So, you know, I think it's reassuring for people because they know whether they're actually okay at the moment or whether they're on a bad path. So I think that it will filter through. And the recent American guidelines, the cholesterol guidance, has just said that calcium scanning can be used with a 2A evidence rating for people who are middle-aged, middle-risk. So I think it's going to come through that we'll start seeing more of it, even in asymptomatic people, especially if they've got a strong family history. Because you don't know until you get the test. That's the basic line. You don't know what you've got going on inside until you've had it done.
Mm. The fact...
I think that we want to try and push this. We want to try and push people to know their numbers. And there's a great campaign from NHS England and Public Health England actually just trying to engage people into saying, well, you know, I should know what my blood pressure is. That's important. I should know, you know, whether I'm at risk of an irregular heartbeat. You know, I should know what my cholesterol is. And they're taking it from that higher level of just trying to get people to know their numbers. What I'm trying to say to people is that, okay, that's important, but did you know that you can drop your blood pressure significantly by altering what you eat? Did you know that you can change your cholesterol significantly by changing what you eat? Did you know potentially that, you know, not having high blood sugar spikes after food might actually help your kidneys to lower your blood pressure? You know, if you fast and don't eat for prolonged periods of time, or maybe have time-restricted eating, you'll actually regenerate your liver LDL receptors anyway, and you won't need a drug to do that. So I think there's lots of therapeutic potential in lifestyle and what people are doing with their eating habits that pharma companies have already created drugs for. And we're the medical paradigm are there to get the drugs out because that's what's in the Lancet and the New England Journal and on the Medscape and the, you know, the latest thing that BMJ or whatever people are reading is that these drugs can do this. But no one talks about the lifestyle changes that could do the same as what the drugs do. So I think that's where it's moving next. And hopefully the BHF and Public Health England, NHS England will start thinking about going down the branches of the tree and getting to the roots and saying, right, okay, we've suggested this about cholesterol and blood pressure, but actual fact, we should maybe be saying to people, these are the things you could do that will affect. And they are doing that to a certain extent, but some of the advice I think is not quite there. You know, still following the eat well plate and loading up on starchy carbohydrates for everybody. And I mean, we need 45 million eat well plates so that everyone knows what they should be eating for them, but we can't individualize it for everybody. We can just take a best guess. But, you know, my best guess is that given that, you know, in the future, 50% of people will probably be diabetic or pre-diabetic or dysglycemic, that we shouldn't be encouraging foods to be consumed with every meal that cause your blood sugar to rise. It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Intuitively, does it? I mean,
I was just talking to Amy Berger earlier, and she was saying pretty much the same thing, you know, in diseases that are clearly linked to, if not caused by, chronic high insulin levels, spikes caused by, you know, in consuming carbohydrates. And then, you know, why isn't that the first line of defense, is to remove that?
Yeah, I mean, I think things will change when more people realize about continuous glucose monitors and postprandial hyperglycemia and those sort of things. And I think we're trying to switch the sort of message to that sort of thing. Don't eat something that's going to disturb your glucose homeostasis. You know, you've got 5 grams of glucose in your entire bloodstream. Why would you go and eat something that had 50 grams of glucose or sugar? And, you know, that's just, the body's like, oh shit, where am I going to put all this? Trying to get homeostasis back. You know, it's, you know, the pancreas is working, you know, overworking to try and make enough to get rid of that. I mean, it's almost like, you know, we want homeostasis back. We want rid of that. We want the blood sugar back to 5 as quickly as possible. But unfortunately, as Kraft says, and as many people have shown before, everyone's insulin dynamics and glucose dynamics are different. So, you know, you don't really know until you maybe do a CGM, you know, how long it's taken for your glucose to come back down, you know, where it is, what peak are you getting, how long is it up for, and then you can maybe start. I think that's when the cognitive change will happen in the population, when, you know, Apple Watch or some sort of Google thing or CGMs become the next, you know, trendy thing to wear. You know, see Kim Kardashian with a CGM on or something like that in some magazine, and then every woman will want a CGM, or, you know, someone on Love Island or something like that will have a CGM on, and then suddenly it'll take off and everyone will be interested in their glucose, and then people will be saying, oh, I shouldn't have a white bread jam sandwich because my glucose goes to 10, you know, and then that won't be cool. You know, who knows what will happen with the Instagram and the next generation. Maybe they will all be walking around wearing CGMs trying to get flat lines and, you know, trying to keep the blood sugar between 4 and 5, and that will be the next big thing. I hope to God it is, but, you know, you just never know, do you?
I wouldn't be at all surprised, actually. And I think, given what's happened with Fitbits, I think people probably like the satisfaction of getting their 5 or 10,000 steps a day, but will probably notice much more of a difference if they flatline their glucose. You know, the next line of attack will have to be the kind of culturally acceptable addiction that most of us have to these types of foods.
Yeah.
And that will be the thing to overcome, that the knowledge will be there and everyone will take it as given that we should be eliminating it, and that will be a great win. But then the next thing is, can you actually eliminate it, which is,
can you do it? Yeah.
Easier said than done.
I mean, you can imagine having some sort of feedback thing where on your watch, you know, you've got a little subcutaneous glucose monitor in it, you know, it actually says to you, it sends you, flashes you a message saying, what did you just eat? Because your blood sugar has just gone to 9. And then, you know, you'll have to put in, sorry, I had a yum yum or something, or, you know, just someone just passed me a couple of like sort of Cadbury's Heroes or something like that. And, you know, and then, you know, hopefully there'll be some sort of logic there, but still I see day in, day out people who, unfortunately for them, have almost like an inherited logic bypass. You know, you say to them, you know that your dad died at 50 of a heart attack, but you still smoke. Did you think that, you know, maybe you shouldn't have smoked because that would have accelerated your path? And it's not even like, oh yeah, I know. It's like, you know, it's like a, oh, right. Oh, I didn't think about that. You know, so there's still, even though we think that, you know, there'll be a breakthrough, there will still unfortunately be, you know, people who just struggle with health literacy. And I think that's a massive thing, is that we should be investing more in primordial prevention. So getting to the kids before they stop believing in Santa and, you know, the Easter Bunny and all that, and actually getting them then when they swallow things whole and saying to them, you know, these are the facts you need to remember. If you eat this, you know, bad things are going to happen. You know, if you do this, you know, you're not going to have as good a health going forward. And there is a guy I know in Warrington who's a cardiologist who's doing this. His name's Ahmed Farag, and he's a cardiologist in Warrington and in Manchester. And he's done this thing in the local schools called Smart Heart, I think it's called. I keep mixing up. I can't remember if it's Heart Smart or Smart Heart. And he basically goes to the kids in primary school and he does a little talk and they do like little drawings for him. And he's absolutely brilliant with them. And he's done like galleries of all the artwork for the kids. I mean, that is real primordial prevention, you know, telling them not to eat sugary drinks and limit their sweets and not to smoke. And he gets letters back from the parents saying, you know, my kid came home with this artwork and said to me, you know, we shouldn't be eating that. And that's really bad for your heart. And that the child out the mouth of babes, it actually has quite a big impact on the parents. So they think, well, you know, if they were told at school, it must be something new. You know, maybe I'll stop taking 5 sugars in my coffee and I'll try and sort that out, you know. So you know, we should be doing a lot more of that as well, getting the kids, because I think there is a lost generation.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's an amazing initiative. I'll look it up and I'll put it in the show notes, I'm trying to remember to put it in the show notes.
His name's Ahmed Farag, and he's a cardiologist in Warrington. In North England.
Great.
Great guy, really nice guy.
To talk about the lost generation, of, you know, getting to that age now where I'm 35 and I'm seeing kind of people who were my heroes when I was a kid starting to get sick with this, that, or the other thing. And, Bob Mortimer is one of my favourite ever comedians. You know, he had to have a triple or quadruple bypass a few years ago.
Yeah, someone told me this, him and Paul thing, they've done this fishing program. Paul Whitehouse.
Yeah, it's funny.
Someone said to me there was something on it that I should look up about them talking about the heart.
Yeah, I mean, I saw one episode and I think Bob Mortimer was just saying, I need to take a statin every day. And then he was tweeting about the show, The Truth About Carbs. He was saying how, you know, is it true that if you put the bread in the freezer, then it reduces the bad carbs in it? So I think there's only so much that new information is going to impact people who are in their 50s or 60s.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think the only hope is that the next generation will have some, you know, following someone on YouTube or Instagram who'll be have like, you know, some ridiculous amount of followers, and they'll be, hey guys, you know, it's such and such, my kids watch banal videos on YouTube of some nutter in America who's got like 50 million followers,
yeah,
and always like throwing balls into swimming pools or freezing swimming pools and diving in it or something. And, you know, it just takes one of those guys who's like some sort of trend leader to come out and say, you know, this is the next big thing. You know, it's probably not even a bad shout to try and get one of these guys on to see if he'll influence like some sort of, you know, masses via YouTube, so that, you know, the next generation don't fall into the same trap that this generation has.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed that the message keeps getting out there and there's a critical mass reached, and then at some point it's just canon that all this stuff is what you do.
I mean, if I can say a plug for something, we've been involved in a documentary called Fighting Failure, which is hopefully going to be on British TV at the end of September. I don't know the exact details yet, but I know it's going to get shown in Parliament around about the 10th of September this year to the Secretary of State for Health and some of the other undersecretaries who are concerned with health. And it's the really moving story of a chap who had a heart attack in his early 40s and was left with really bad heart failure. And it's about the fact that this happened to his father at the same age, but his father didn't survive. He just died. He's now suffering with it. And the documentary is mainly about his struggle. But there's a nod to his younger, his son, his only son, who just looks like he looked like in the photographs of him and his dad. So it's just like, you know, the chronicles of life and death type of thing. And, you know, the story starts to turn towards the young kid, Tyler, and what we can do to try and stop him from falling into the same traps that his dad did. So his dad was diabetic without really knowing he was, and he smoked, and his diet wasn't really great, and obviously had the bad genetics. And we've since had a continuous glucose monitor on this kid, and we've shown that actually when he eats certain foods, high glycemic index foods, he does a double spike in blood sugar. So against his mum's CGM, his mum's very lean, thin woman. When she eats the same food as him, her blood sugar just goes up and straight back down again. Maybe goes to about, you know, if it's something really quite sugary, it'll go to like 6.5, 7, and then comes straight back down. What his does, goes up to like sort of 7.5, then comes down, then spikes back up again to like 8.5, 9. So his period, his window is like almost like his glycemic load is much higher, and his residence time for high blood sugar is much longer than his presumably insulin sensitive mother. So they've managed to flatline his CGMs, and he started losing weight because he, you know, the kid had a little bit of excess weight on. And the hope is that the documentary will spin round and have a message about how your average punter on the street can start using some techniques to stop them from, you know, potentially having that same response. You don't know what your response is until you've got a CGM on. Mm-hmm. You know, it's called Fighting Failure, and it's about the language around heart failure as well, because the guy didn't deal very well with this failure thing. You know, your heart's failed, I failed, you know, those sort of, so maybe the wording around heart failure might change as a result of this. So there's a campaign going on to try and recognize heart failure, the symptoms of heart failure, and how someone should be best treated. So look out for that. It's probably going to be the end of September. Maybe, I don't know which television channel's got the rights to it. I'd heard Channel 4 might have it, but I'm not entirely sure. But it should be another, you know, one that we can use to hopefully get the masses sort of awakened.
That's brilliant. I'm glad to hear it. And I'm looking forward to seeing it. Sounds like an inspirational story.
It is. I mean, it's a tearjerker. We showed a clip of it at the British Cardiac Society this year in June, just to say this is happening. We're having this campaign called Fighting Failure. And there was audience maybe of about 50 or 60 people in our session for BACPR. And the guy actually stood up and did a talk, the main guy who's in it. And everyone was just in bits at it, because, you know, there's some really quite sort of heart-wrenching bits in it when the little boy says to him, you know, I like my old daddy better, you know, the one who wasn't breathless all the time, and those sort of things. And, you know, it's just, it's really quite sort of real. You know, he's Sunil Modi Nichols, the guy who's in the documentary. You know, he's fantastic about how hard he's worked to get to where he is, because many other people would, you know, wouldn't have made it through. And I think now he's actually embraced the low-carb way of tackling his diabetes. He's actually reversed his diet, well, put his diabetes into remission. And whilst he was having to drain a lot of fluid off his body when he was on his old diet because of his heart failure and the effects on his liver, he was having to drain fluid off his abdomen. He found that after he went low carb, he was only draining 2 liters of fluid a week when he used to drain 6 liters of fluid. So he found the amount of fluid he was actually had on his body was down by, you know, 2/3, just from not, you know, changing his diet to just protein and healthy fat. So I'm hoping if plenty of people see this documentary, it might trigger something in them saying, well, maybe I don't need these. I don't need my 2 rounds of toast with every meal.
It's funny how, you know, the hopes you have to be tempered by the knowledge that maybe that's the win here. You know, that it's just, you know, cutting out all the mad excesses and not expecting everyone to be keto warriors.
Yeah, no, I think that's possibly swinging too far. I mean, we just want, you'll find that there are like I said, there's two or three things that people are doing, myself included, from time to time, where I just think, why did I do that? You know, and then you like I ate a bit of my son's birthday cake the other day, and then afterwards I felt like I was getting some sort of rage on. It was actually weird because I hadn't had anything of that nature for quite a while. It had like a weird effect on me. I felt almost like I was flushing up, or, you know, and then I felt like sort of, you know, quite angry for some reason. I don't know whether I was just angry at myself or like what I had ate made me feel more angry. It's weird. I don't know whether anyone else gets that when they haven't had anything like that for a while, and then you have something, you kind of go a bit weird. Maybe it's just me.
No, I definitely do. And when I was experimenting first with my diet, and I did a very strict elimination diet, and I would add something back in, I noticed the profound effect on my moods. And it would be so pronounced that I came to think that probably a lot of people's mood swings are literally just down to the fact that they're having blood sugar swings, or they're feeding they're feeding bacteria in their gut that have got, you know, somehow emit something, or it's them dying or something that get into the bloodstream and then causes some sort of mood symptom, and that, or, you know, they're jacking themselves up on caffeine and then they're crashing with that, and that, you know, they talk about zero carbs in, and how I found that if I'm eating really well, then I'm extremely calm and I actually respond very appropriately emotionally to things.
Yeah, I felt that myself. And the other thing that I don't do well, it doesn't help, is I don't get as much sleep as I should do. And I think that if you've got all your ducks in a row, like you say, you're eating really clean, you're sleeping enough, you've not got that much alcohol going through that you're not sleeping as well, you got less caffeine needs, because, you know, I tend to substitute caffeine for lack of sleep because I'm up at night doing, you know, reports or stuff for work. And so, you know, if you, like you say, if you've got all that in a row, you actually feel like a more functional human being. And I think I'm actually better with my kids. You know, relationships are better, you know, when all that's in a row. But as I say, I think it's maybe something to do with, I mean, maybe Robbie Lustig knows, you know, when you get hyperglycemia, what happens to, you know, dopamine in the nucleus accumbens or whatever it is, your dopamine and serotonin. He's always going on about the fact that dopamine depletes serotonin, and that if you're constantly getting dopamine highs from whatever you're doing, drugs, food, whatever addiction it is you've got, then you're actually ultimately depleting serotonin, and serotonin is your happiness hormone. And that you need that. So there's a whole load of people who are on serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs, for depression, and that, you know, are they on them just because the dopamine's suppressing the serotonin, and it's just that you ultimately could be fixed by diet or lifestyle change. So I mean, there's a huge sort of potential for all of this. It's just trying to stick with it is difficult sometimes in life's roller coaster.
But I guess, like, as long as people are making four out of five good choices rather than four out of five bad choices, then they're moving in the right direction.
Yeah, I mean, it's like it's just maybe writing down what things could I do, what the low hanging fruit, what are these things I could achieve, and then if you feel better, you're more likely, you feel like you're in control. It's almost like you've become an activated patient in a way. And we talk about that in medicine, patient activation measures. What's it going to take to actually get this person to just take control of their own health? And occasionally it could be that, you know, they just realize, wow, I feel so much better. Clarity of thought. I don't feel as foggy. I'm not falling asleep, you know, after a meal. I mean, the other day I actually made some porridge for one of my kids. He said he wanted porridge. For some reason he wanted porridge with apple in it. So I made him some porridge in the morning with apple, and there was like porridge left and I was hungry. So I just like, whapped down about 4 or 5 spoons of porridge and drunk my coffee and got in the car. And as I was driving through the Mersey Tunnel to work, because I live in the Wirral, and so I was driving from the Wirral to into Liverpool, go through the tunnel, I actually nearly dropped off in the tunnel. I was just like, you know, I could feel it hitting me. I was like, but, you know, eyes were crossing. I was like, wow, you know, I normally don't feel like that at all in the morning because I've had a coffee and nothing to eat. But for some reason, this porridge must have just spiked me or something, and I was just gone. So, wow. You know, not be having porridge again in the morning.
Well, it's been a really great chat, and
okay, great.
I really appreciate it, and I think I'm glad to just be getting the kind of wisdom from your Twitter out into the podcast world and let people consume it in a different way.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me on. I really enjoyed it, and I'll look up the meals, and me and Sylvia, if you get an order from Liverpool, or from the Wirral, then you'll notice us, and we'll sample some of your delicacies. It sounds really nice.
Okay.
And we'll try and spread the word as much as we can. I wish you the best of success for the business, because if we need, you know, what you're doing is exactly what we need. We need it to be everywhere. You know, you need some funding to get some massive billboard campaign or something on the side of buses. You know,
that's it.
Just don't sell out to Domino's or something. They want to come and take you over and then chuck in a free pizza with it.
I'll right, try Ali, my best to resist that temptation.
All right, take care of yourself. We'll find out how you're getting on.
Thanks, Scott.
All right, all the best.
Cheers now.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening, everyone. Please don't forget to jump over to iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts and hit the subscribe button. And please don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review to get the podcast in front of your eyes. This podcast is made possible thanks to paleocanteen.co.uk, which is my company. Paleocanteen.co.uk is the UK's one-stop paleo low-carb food provider, where you can get restaurant-quality meals, grass-fed Scottish beef and lamb, outdoor bred pork, and a selection of paleo and low-carb products delivered chilled to your door. That's paleocanteen.co.uk. Use the code CANTEEN15, that's CANTEEN15, to get 15% off your first order. Thanks, see you next time.